Ominous warnings of threats to democracies as leaders gather to commemorate the day the world was freed from the threat of Hitler's tyranny.
The price of unchecked tyranny is the blood of the young and the brave. In their generation, in their hour of trial, the Allied forces of D-Day did their duty. Now the question for us is, in our hour of trial, will we do ours?
The other major red alert warning this week.
The record-breaking temperature we've just lived through will be remembered, likely, with, at least in the near future, as cold temperature, because the temperature will keep going up.
And with that, the UN chief urges companies around the world to fight big oil as they did years ago with big tobacco.
Our planet is trying to tell us something, but we don't seem to be listening.
Today is Saturday, June 8th. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hello, I'm Lori London in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden is in France participating in somber ceremonies marking the 80th anniversary of the Allied invasion of Normandy. Biden also urged the need for unity against Russian aggression during the memorial marking one of the largest battles of World War II. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Omaha Beach, Normandy, France.
This is where 80 years ago, the first wave of 160,000 Allied troops stormed Normandy's beaches. Their grueling assault loosened Nazi Germany's hold on France, leading to the end of World War II. President Joe Biden speaking near the cemetery where 9,387 American troops are laid to rest, emphasized that these global challenges are not in the past, and urged unity in resisting Russian aggression today.
We will not walk away. Because if we do, Ukraine will be subjugated, and it will not end there. Ukraine's neighbors will be threatened. All of Europe will be threatened. And make no mistake, the autocrats of the world are watching closely to see what happens in Ukraine, to see if we let this illegal aggression go unchecked. We cannot let that happen. To surrender to bullies, to bow down to dictators, is simply unthinkable.
Prominent at the ceremony, a small, dwindling number of surviving veterans. On Thursday, French President Emmanuel Macron presented 11 of them, not one under the age of 98, with France's top distinction, the Legion of Honor.
À l'été 1944, vous aviez 20 ans à peine, parfois moins.
In the summer of 1944, you were barely 20 years old.
Des amis, une fiancée, une femme, parfois des enfants. Vous aviez des rêves, des projets, un avenir.
You had dreams, plans,
et vous
future,
avez tout quitté.
And you left everything, crossed franchi the ocean, and landed on the shores of France
sur les côtes de
ago.
France.
You left everything and took all the risks for our independence, for our
vous
freedom.
We will not forget this. Pris tous les risques.
Thank you.
What these once young men did, military experts say, is remarkable. This was the largest amphibious assault in history. Mark Kansian is a retired Marine colonel and a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Amphibious operations are probably the most difficult of all military operations because you have to build up combat power from zero. In other words, when the operation kicks off, you have no combat power ashore. You're facing an opponent who is dug in and likely expecting you. So you have to build up that combat power under very difficult circumstances and then push inland.
World leaders and luminaries signaled their appreciation at Thursday's event. But for the French people, this is a special day. Léonie Allard is a visiting fellow at the Atlantic Council's Europe Center and a former French defense official.
Recall how much the contribution and the U.S. engagement changed the fate of the continent at that time. And probably project some of the lessons of that we take from that engagement regarding the challenges we're facing today in Europe with the return of war in the continent due to Russia's aggression of Ukraine.
But the price was steep and paid with the most valuable treasure that any nation holds. It's brave youth. Anita Powell, VOA News, Omaha Beach, Normandy.
And while paying tribute to veterans, President Biden stressed the importance of international alliances, warning democracy is facing its greatest risk since World War II.
What the Allies did together 80 years ago far surpassed anything we could have done on our own. It was a powerful illustration of how alliances, real alliances, make us stronger. A lesson that I pray we Americans never forget.
Joining us now is David Greenberg, historian and professor of media studies at Rutgers University. Thank you so much for being with us. So, is it safe to say that the rising global threats to democracy add another layer of significance to this anniversary of the turning point in World War II?
I think that's probably true. I'm always a little bit hesitant to draw too neat a parallel. That being said, we do have a war going on right in the heart of Europe based on many of the same principles and concerns that were at stake in World War II. Do powers like Germany and Russia have the right to invade their neighbors and claim land, whether it's a slice of land or the entirety of a country? And for many decades, but especially since World War II, the world has more or less come to the conclusion that no, that that's a violation of international law, that violates all of our basic principles. Even non-democratic, illiberal countries at least are supposed to pay lip service to those ideals. So the Russian invasion of Ukraine certainly marks a big, it has created a great test for the ideals. So what we saw at stake in World War II, and we could use D-Day or any number of markers to exemplify that, is in that sense also at stake today.
President Biden, in a speech in Normandy Thursday, called D-Day a powerful illustration of how alliances, real alliances, make us stronger, a lesson that he said he prays that we Americans never forget. And of course, that comment comes at a time where European allies are concerned about the alliance and commitments of the United States to be a part of that alliance, given the upcoming presidential election and a different frame of thought about our alliances to Europe from the perspective of the presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump. He's not been in favor of the NATO alliance, and many on the continent, leaders are fearful of the transatlantic unity not surviving.
That sort of exemplifies a big difference between Trump and his Republican predecessors. Under George Bush Jr., we did see a certain unilateralism, a certain willingness to, quote, go at it alone, even when allies were not on board. But that did not extend to sacrificing alliances, particularly the NATO alliance, altogether, right? It was sort of saying, we'll act alone when we need to. And that was controversial at the time. Trump comes along with a very reactionary form of conservatism, or reactionary form of nationalism, that takes us all the way back, to Charles Lindbergh, and again to the pre-World War II era, where he not only doesn't care about acting in concert with allies, but shows sort of open contempt or disregard for our allies and our alliances. And that's dangerous. That should be of concern to Americans as well as, of course, the Europeans. And it really does mark, a really big difference between the parties. I mean, I think for most of the post-World War II era, leaders of both the Democrats and the Republicans, certainly the presidents who led the country, agreed on a kind of liberal internationalism. There were variations in how they might execute it. Someone like Reagan might be more, militaristic in his approach, and someone like Jimmy Carter more timid in his approach. But they all basically subscribe to the same philosophy. Trump is an outlier. But the other thing I think that's concerning is you see a lot more dissent in the Democratic Party ranks than you ever used to, maybe excepting around the time of Vietnam a little bit. So you're starting to see what I consider demagoguery with the phrase forever war, which, of course, there's no such thing. There's an occupation can follow a war, but that doesn't mean the war is going on forever. And so you see creeping into the Democratic Party, too, some isolationism. And Biden really represents, a very pure well-formulated commitment to the ideas of internationalism and collective security that FDR first articulated on behalf of the Democratic Party and on behalf of America.
Well, the war in Ukraine and, of course, persistent threats that it could escalate across Ukraine's borders into other European countries is obviously a pretty ominous backdrop to the D-Day ceremony. And Biden literally warned that democracy is more at risk across the world than at any point since the end of World War II. Do you agree?
I'm always wary of that kind of categorical statement. You know, I think we might find moments, again, around the time of Vietnam, maybe around the time of the late 70s, early 80s, where there's a kind of revival of Cold War mentality that caused a lot of instability. But I think Biden certainly has a strong case to make. It's not an unreasonable claim. It's not an absurd claim.
Are we not seeing a rise in populism and autocratic people that want to change their countries to more autocratic philosophies, and rise in autocracies is threatening democracies around the world?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no question about it. I mean, for most of my adult lifetime, we really saw democracy spreading Eastern Europe, South Africa, parts of Asia. It even seemed like China might be moving in that direction, or Russia. There was a period, particularly in the late 80s and 90s, where democracy seemed ascendant. And I think we are now seeing movement in the other direction. Countries that maybe haven't given up totally on democracy, that they still have elections, nonetheless embrace autocratic or authoritarian leaders. We see it on the left with people in Latin America, Morales and Maduro and Lula. And we see it on the right with Bolsonaro and Erdogan in Turkey, Orban in Hungary. So it's absolutely the case that countries that seemed to have transitioned successfully to democracy, you know, are now looking a lot shakier. And look, Ukraine and the other former Soviet republics are relatively recent democracies in that, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union was not very long ago. And many of these people desperately want to keep their democracies strong. So which is why in some ways Eastern Europe and particularly Ukraine, you know, are such a litmus test. You know, Ukraine has been emerging and has been developing into a democracy. It's not without its problems, but this, should Russia succeed, this will be an enormous setback, to put it mildly.
Given the fact that these world leaders are in France celebrating the 80th anniversary of D-Day, it does seem like this underlying theme of concern that democracy is in danger, that there is a struggle now.
Yes. And again, particularly compared with, say, the 1990s, where democracy really was ascendant and we could have confidence that the world overall was moving in a more democratic direction. Yeah, I don't think we can say that anymore. I mean, we can still have hope and we can still have that as a legitimate goal for American foreign policy to continue to expand democracy. But, you know, it now is the hard part. You know, now we're seeing the forces of reaction in lots of different countries. And, you know, I do think the memory and legacy of D-Day are important here. It was during World War II, and maybe especially at D-Day, that some of these ideas really crystallized. You know, the idea of fighting for democracy, you know, for what FDR called the four freedoms. And so it's reasonable, it makes sense that Joe Biden or other political leaders would sort of reach for that language and that memory and those traditions to sort of remind us of how difficult it was to sort of secure a widely shared vision of a free and democratic world. You know, it didn't come easy. It was hard fought. It was hard won. And through the sheer difficulty of D-Day, the lives lost, the carnage, the importance of the battle, but, you know, the difficulty of the battle too, all that sort of symbolizes that democracy is not secured easily, you know, that it often does require a fight, a military fight, diplomatic fight, ideological fight. And I think, you know, I think really think it is one of Joe Biden's strengths. He gets that. He's always gotten that. And it's always been his greatest strength as a president, his understanding of the world picture. And I think it separates him from Trump. And as I said, I think it also separates him from a lot of younger Democrats. If you look at the people he ran against 4 years ago for the Democratic Party nomination, it's hard to find one of them who would be as good a leader on foreign policy, as sophisticated in his understanding of collective security and liberal internationalism. They might, in the end, come down with some similar policies, but, you know, Biden really gets this in his bones.
David Greenberg, historian and professor of media studies at Rutgers University. Thank you very much for being with us. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. A not-so-subtle warning this week from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres in an address to the American Museum of Natural History as climate records are shattered and emissions continue to rise.
We are playing Russian roulette with our planet. And we need an exit ramp off the highway to climate hell.
The burning of fossil fuels, namely oil, gas, and coal, being the main contributors to global warming caused by human activity.
Climate change is the mother of all stealth taxes paid by everyday people and vulnerable countries and communities. Meanwhile, the godfathers of climate chaos, the fossil fuel industry, rake in record profits and feast off trillions in taxpayer-funded subsidies.
On World Environment Day Wednesday, the UN chief urged countries to confront not just the fossil fuel industry, but also companies that support efforts to obstruct progress and sow doubt about climate change.
I call on these companies to stop acting as enablers of planetary destruction. Stop taking on new fossil fuel clients from today and set out plans to drop your existing ones. Fossil fuels are not only poisoning our planets, they are toxic for your brands.
The EU's Copernicus Climate Change Service Wednesday reported that last month was the hottest May ever, marking the 12th consecutive monthly record high. Separately, the World Meteorological Organization issued temperature predictions for the next 5 years. WMO Deputy Secretary General Co Barrett.
And the statistics are startling. There is a nearly 9 in 10 likelihood that at least 1 year between 2024 and 2028 will be the hottest on record, even hotter than 2023, which smashed all temperature records.
Most of the planet has suffered the dire effects of extreme heat in recent years and certainly in recent weeks across Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America. Barrett said the future scenarios many have feared are already here.
As our planet enters this new record-breaking era, we can expect to see more oppressive heat waves affecting the health of billions of people, more increases in marine heat waves, jeopardizing livelihoods and natural ecosystems along our coasts. More sea level rise threatening coastal populations everywhere. More intense rainfall events pushing our infrastructure beyond its limits.
And a study released Tuesday by 57 scientists said that as the world keeps burning fossil fuels, Earth is likely to reach the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit in 4.5 years. Barrett said the 1.5 degrees Celsius Paris Agreement target is not yet dead, but it's hanging by a thread. Joining us now is Carlo Buontempo, director of the EU climate service Copernicus, to talk about the agency's latest report on the heat record.
Over the last few years, the Copernicus Climate Change Service of the European Commission has been monitoring the climate and providing updates every month. And the last 12 months have been rather unusual because they have been, each one of them at their moment in time, has been the warmest month we have ever recorded. So our data set goes back to 1940, actually January 1940, and every single month of the last 12 months have been warmer than any previous month in this record. From what we know, this is also very likely to be the warmest 12-month period in a much longer data set, spanning probably thousands, if not tens of thousands of years. And on top of this element, so this is not the only time that we have a long streak of record-breaking month. It happened before in 2015 and 16, which was also an El Niño record. But it's the first time that 11 of these 12 months are above 1.5 degrees countries with respect to pre-industrial. So since July last year, July 2023, every single month, including May, has been above 1.5. And this is the warmest 12-month period ever recorded in our data set.
Is this as something that was predicted, or is it happening faster than previously predicted?
To some extent, both things are true, because if you look at what the climate model told us some 20 years ago about the kind of temperature we were likely to experience in the 2020s, well, we were not too far off from the temperature we're seeing now. So I would argue that the climate information, the climate data, the climate model provided useful guidance that maybe we didn't listen enough to. That said, there were surprises in 23. There are things we have not fully understood. The speed of some of the changes was higher than expected, and this calls for more research. So we don't understand everything, but I would argue we understand a significant part of what we see. And maybe as a society, we haven't yet taken full advantage of this knowledge, this data, and this insight that the climate science provides.
We've been seeing some really devastating weather events pretty much all across the globe. What can we expect to come?
These streaks of record-breaking months at some point will stop. We won't continue breaking record forever. But this, it would probably be momentarily. It will happen only momentarily, because there is a tendency towards a warmer climate. So maybe next month, or in 2 months, or maybe in 6 months, we will have a month that is not record-breaking. And this will tell very little about the bigger picture. We are going towards warmer temperature, and it's basically certain that the average temperature of the next 5 years or 10 years would be higher than the average temperature of the last 5 years or last 10 years. So we are already in basically uncharted territory. We are going towards warmer temperature, and it's enough to read what the IPCC told us a few years back about what to expect. So we do expect intense precipitation to become more intense, and this is already seen in the observation, so you don't need a climate model to see that. We do expect drought to become more widespread, heat wave to we have seen just in the last few days the heat waves affecting India, affecting part of the Middle East and Africa. These heat waves will become more frequent, more last longer, and more intense. So these are some of these of the example of what we have to expect. And on the time scale of the next few years, we don't have much control. So the temperature will go up, will continue to go up. And in a sense, the record-breaking temperature we've just lived through will be remembered, you know, likelihood, at least in the near future, as cold temperature, because temperature will keep going up. That said, if we put our act together and we reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases and we stabilize the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, we still do have a chance of coming back to this cold temperature by the end of the century.
Are carbon emissions being reduced at all across the board, or is it just not at a fast enough?
Well, that's a bit interesting to some extent, because the emission as such may have reduced as a consequence of also of the pandemic. So we are not yet back. It's not something that we mentioned in our report ourselves, but there was a paper coming out of the University of Leeds looking at these indicators. And what the authors have found is that we are not yet at the level of emission that we had before the pandemic, but we are not decreasing either. And given that the climate responds not so much about our pledges in terms of emissions, or not even to emission themselves, what it responds to is the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere has not stabilized, keep rising, and if anything, has kept rising at a slightly higher rate than before.
Obviously, we're seeing, as we mentioned, devastating weather events with flooding and mudslides and heat waves and drought. Yeah. And should we be expecting more of the same?
We are not yet on a steady state. It's not a new normal. Things are still warming up. We're still in a transient. So things will get worse in terms of temperature. There is very little doubt about it. So in a sense, for me, the element of reflection is the fact that we are not blind in front of these changes. We do have useful data. We do have useful insight, useful information. And especially on the data. Well, data for me is what's happening, is a reflection of reality. And it shouldn't be an element of ideological debate or discussion. It's just where we are. We have to be realistic and react to the fact we have. So that's for me my appeal, if you want. Let's look at the data. Let's look at the observation. Let's look at the information we have. And let's discuss on what is the best way of reacting to the current setup. I like to think that facts, information, and data are a very good ingredient for decisions and policies.
All right. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Carlo Buontempo, director of the EU Climate Service, Copernicus. And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.